Good afternoon, and welcome to Spokane Public Radio's Northwest Arts Review, a half hour exploring the people, places, and events forming the rich arts tapestry we enjoy here in the Inland Northwest and our wider Intermountain Northwest region. I'm Jim Tevenin, pleased to be your guide on this journey. We've had a couple of weeks off as election-related programs took center stage, but we're back, featuring a pair of conversations from the realms of literature and visual arts. Chris Messini's guest is Spokane author Jess Walter, whose new novel is called Cold Millions. Our second guest is Rich Wanschneider, librarian and fount of much information about the Josefi Center for Arts and Culture in Joseph, Oregon. Dan Webster reviews a new Netflix offering, and we celebrate our return with some spirited music from the EWU Wind Ensemble, led by Patrick Winters. This is Northwest Arts Review.
For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini. My guest today is Jess Walter. He's the author of 8 books, including the number 1 New York Times bestseller, Beautiful Ruins, The Zero, which was a finalist for the National Book Award, and Citizen Vince, winner of the Edgar Award. His new novel is The Cold Millions. It's set in Spokane during the labor disputes of the early 20th century and has been hailed by the Philadelphia Inquirer as a Scorsese-esque period piece populated by cops, drunks, variety girls, temperance ladies, job sharks, Pinkertons, and Wobblies. Jess lives here in his hometown, Spokane, and he joins me now to talk about the new novel. Jess, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be here.
Well, I thought I'd start by talking about Spokane. So a lot of your fiction takes place in Spokane or somehow deals with characters or places around the Inland Northwest. But this novel is the first time that you really dove into a particular piece of Spokane history. So what piqued your interest in exploring the Wobblies and the free speech fights of the 1900s?
Boy, there were so many things that sort of came together to make me want to write about this period. I'd always wanted to write about the early 20th century in Spokane, in part because it exists so much in the world we see now. The architecture, every house I've lived in has been built between 1906 and 1909 for the last 30 years anyway. And so, you know, it just feels ubiquitous to me. It's when Spokane was doubling in size every 6 or 7 years. And when I started doing the research, I just pictured this place that was becoming a modern city, really more respected than Seattle at the time, you know, other than San Francisco for theater, for wealth. Spokane was really one of the coming Western cities, but it also have the shades of this old Western town. And to read about the wild things that happened, that was sort of the first impulse. The second one was much more current, reading about the social unrest, the riots, the income inequality of the end of the Gilded Age. It felt like a way to write about the current moment while also writing about this period that had just always fascinated me.
Yeah, well, before we get there, I want to introduce a couple of the characters. So your main character is a 16-year-old boy named Rye Dolan. And when the book starts, he's sort of tramping around with his older brother, Gig, and they're looking for work, sort of picking up things where they can. I wonder if you could read a section of the book to sort of get us into the world and the style of these characters for us.
Sure. I won't read the prologue, but I'll read just start from the first chapter with those two characters waking up. They woke on a ball field. Bums, tramps, hobos, stiffs, 2 dozen of them spread out on bedrolls and blankets in a narrow floodplain just below the skid, past taverns, tanners, and tents, shotgun shacks hung like hound's tongues over the Spokane River. seasonal work over. They floated in from mines and farms and log camps, filled every flop and boarding house, slept in parks and alleys and pavilions of traveling preachers, and on the night just past, this abandoned ball field, its infield littered with itinerants, vagrants, floaters, Americans. The sun was just beginning to edge the mountains when Rye Dolan sat up, halfway down the first base line. He looked across a field of sleeping humps, his older brother Gig beside him, curled a few feet from the pitcher's mound. Rye turned back to watch the sunrise over the Selkirks, a smoky red gash where someone had set a fire to get a job fighting it. Last year, Rye might have paid to get a shovel on that blaze, but Gig had gone and joined the IWW, the union fighting the corrupt employment agents who charged a buck for job leads. Left untended, that same dollar could bring his older brother plenty of trouble, like last night. Pay in pocket, Gig Dolan liked to bounce from Dutch Jakes to Jimmy Durkin's until the money ran out. And while caring for Rye the past year had half-tamed him, they were coming off 3 weeks apart, Rye picking up a late harvest near Rockford, Gig getting on a skid crew at a Springdale log camp. Fired for union agitating, Gig came back to booze it up with his East End labor pals and hawk day work at the city's vaudeville theaters. And it was there, among the freaks and jugglers, the variety houses and leg shows, that he happened to meet an actress named Ursula. Rye back in Spokane less than an hour before his brother was showing him a newspaper review of her show. And therein, Gig said.
That was my guest, Jess Walter, reading from his new novel, The Cold Millions. So apart from those fictional characters, Rye and Gig and others, there's also several real historical people that we meet in this novel. Notably, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was a real-life labor organizer. She plays a really central role in the novel, as well as a real-life police chief of Spokane. So what was the process like bringing those historical people to life as fictional characters?
Yeah, that's an interesting part for me, to be doing this research and to find, you know, the real story of the labor riots of 1909, including Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, the pregnant 19-year-old who comes to Spokane and is, you know, and leads these riots in a way that I found remarkable. You know, I would find it remarkable now, but in 1909, 11 years before she had the right to vote, just the sort of audacity and courage of someone like that, that was a character that you just wanted to try to depict in fiction. And, you know, for me, it was kind of a great thrill, because some of those characters are just as beguiling and fascinating as anyone I could have been.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe even more so. I mean, I think, yeah, especially Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, like you said, a 19-year-old pregnant labor organizer. If you'd made her up, she'd be almost too unbelievable for the time period.
Yeah, there were times I was working on the book, I was afraid that, you know, that she would almost take it over, because her story is so rich. And in the end, I wrote the longest afterword I ever have written, just to sort of explain which parts of the novel were factual, because as a reader, that's what I would have wanted to know at the very end of the book. So rather than be coy and pretend as if I'd made all this up, I wanted to share with people a bit of my research process.
Yeah. Well, that afterword is helpful to sort of unpack, because that is, I think, especially now, the first thing I would want to do is go to Wikipedia and sort of figure out which characters are real and which ones are not. So
I think that's a triumph of historical fiction, if it makes you want to go read more about it. And and so I hope people will. I hope they'll go read Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's autobiography or the stories of her life, or read more about that early Spokane history.
Yeah. Well, my guest has been Jess Walter. His new novel is The Cold Millions. Jess, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Chris.
Chris Messini's full conversation with Jess Walter is available as a podcast on the bookshelf page of our website, SpokanePublicRadio.org. A visit to Oregon's Wallowa Valley, where we are heard at 89.3, by the way, is a journey well rewarded by spectacular scenery, abundant opportunities to experience wilderness, and more, including the Josefi Center for Arts and Culture in Joseph, a welcoming place to experience a wide variety of first-rate regional art. I had a chance to learn a lot about the center from someone who should know, librarian Rich Wanschneider.
About a dozen years ago, a woman moved back to town after years in the East, where she had been involved with the Arts Center in New York, where the Winter Olympics are. Where is that place?
Lake Placid.
Lake Placid, yeah. And she came back here and started walking around, and she met some artists, and she saw this vacant building. And she said, God, that would be a great art center. So she got a grant to do a feasibility study, and they said, yeah, it'd be a great art center, and you could run one here, but you couldn't retire a debt. So she went back home and sat on that for 2 or 3 years, and the building was empty, and she inherited some money. And she called me up and several other people and said, let's have an art center. I'll buy it, and we'll form a new nonprofit. And when the nonprofit's healthy, they can buy it back from me at my cost. And she knew me from Fish Trap, and I was sitting in the basement at Fish Trap with boxes and boxes of Alvin Josefi's books. Alvin Josefi was the historian of the Nez Perce who brought them back to national attention in the 1960s. He helped me start Fish Trap in 1988, and I had his books. Ann bought the building. We moved the books up here, and with some help from local friends, we started a new nonprofit.
Before we go any further, for those who are unfamiliar, if you could fill us in on Fish Trap.
In 1988, Alvin Josefi, the historian, and Kim Stafford, recently our poet laureate, and I combined and started a new nonprofit called Fish Trap. We started it with a gathering of writers at Wallowa Lake in the summer at the old Methodist camp, and it evolved, and Fish Trap became known across the region as a nonprofit promoting writers and writing in the West. And over 30-odd years, most of the major writers of the West have been at Fish Trap, which now is virtual, just as everybody else is. So Alvin helped me with that, as did Kim. So when we moved up here, we had a new board, and I didn't want to work full time. So I became the immediate halftime person. I also didn't want to head up another nonprofit because I was past that age. So I said I'd do the library, and I'd do some programming and some writing grants and that kind of thing. And we hired a director and hired some and had a board, and they all came up, well, why don't we call it the Josefi Center? So it became the Josefi Center for Arts and Culture. The library is the Alvin and Betty Josefi of Western History and Culture. So that was about a dozen years ago. Went through a kind of a shakedown cruise process there, and Cheryl Coughlin became the director about 9 years ago. Cheryl has a background in art history, and she met her husband in New York City, and her husband was from here. And she was working in the arts and promotion in New York City, and came out here, and she was actually working in the circuit court office here. So she got involved first on the board, and then came time to have a new director, and Cheryl was hired. She brought her background in art history. We had already started teaching some classes. She ramped that up. Now we have a full schedule of art classes. Well, we did until recently. They've just reopened. They've reopened with social distancing and all of that. But so we teach art classes here for students on Fridays. We have a 4-day school week. And Cheryl managed the exhibit schedule. We do 6 to 8 exhibits each year. Some of them are recurring. We have a women's exhibit every March. We have a Eastern Oregon landscape exhibit once a year. We have some exhibit that has to do with Indians every year. I was telling you last year it was Nez Perce music. and how the boarding schools used music as an assimilation tool, and how the Indians came back and played jazz. An interesting story. We've done exhibits on the Nez Perce salmon and dams. We've done joint shows with Crow Shadow on the Umatilla Reservation, the Art Institute there. But the rest of the time, every once in a while, we've had exhibits devoted to a single artist. Steve Arment, a local artist, did probably the most well-attended show exhibit we've ever had, called The Circus of Arment. And he draped this whole thing and made carousel horses and rocking pigs and teeter-totter this and fortune booth that. And we sold quite a bit of his very original art. So we have those specialty exhibits, plus we have the standard, the women's exhibit. This year we did a special little side exhibit on suffrage, being the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. We work with schools, we work with the Nez Perce Homeland Project, we work with Willow Resources, we work with all the other nonprofits here. And it really is a center for arts and culture. I was telling you earlier, we had an exhibit this year that we had to do virtually, and it was social media of Willow, of the Willows, 1906 to 1915. It was postcards, 20 postcards, front and back. We released them one a day online, with a mini essay by David Weaver, who's a local man who is becoming an authority on local photography. And he explained how, with the advent of the Brownie camera and the picture postcards, you could send your film in and get postcards back, and they became the equivalent of social media of today. So we had a professional reader. David was a good writer, but he didn't want to read his stuff. And so we released them one a day for 20 days, and we made a book out of it, which is a very nice book, which tells some of the history of Willow County, some of the history of photography, and some of the history of social media. So that book's available, that catalog's available for sale. And I think during the pandemic, we've learned. We're a small arts agency, arts and cultural agency, but we have access to big things. I didn't tell you, but right here we have one of 500 sets of the complete works of Edward Sheriff Curtis, the photographer of American Indians from 1900 to 1930. It was donated to us by a patron, okay? And people are welcome to, we don't check out those books, but people are coming in to look at them. So we have access to stuff here, but we're small enough so that we're agile. So we could learn better how to do Zoom meetings. We have Zoom meetings all the time. We have a Zoom book club, you know? So we've learned how to use some of that technology. We've learned how to produce books. They're better and better, our art catalogs, okay? Because they're more professional and they're better done better, and we get them out quicker all the time. There's a new one out on the last Eastern Oregon landscape show that we did this summer. And that one, now what we're doing as we do a real show in the gallery. We don't have a gallery opening because we usually get 100 to 300 people at a gallery opening. We don't do that. The opening is virtual, but the artwork is up. The current show is actually, I forget the official name, but it's What You Did During Lockdown. So it's some very crazy kind of art, including an old farmer collector of antique tractors who used extra parts to put together little hydraulic things and stuff that blow whistles and shoot water around, you know, but also paintings and some beautiful quilts. What You Did During Lockdown. So Willow County Photography Club is the next exhibit. Probably do the same thing. There'll be a physical show here in the gallery. We can let in 15 people or so at a time. Tourists have been coming to Willow County this summer, and local people come. And then we'll put that up online so you can see our shows past shows virtually as well, online in our archives. I've got to tell you that the earlier shows are not represented as well online as we're doing it now. We're getting better. So it's, you know, it's a great place to work. We get people from all over the world come in here. Oftentimes they come in chasing, they've read about Chief Joseph and they want to know where he lived. So that's a key to our deal, you know. But also Joseph is now known as an art town. So we get people chasing art. I think one of the biggest things we've done in terms of art, and all of Oregon is responsible because it was funded by Oregon Community Foundation. We realized about 3 years ago that Joseph is an art town and there are 12 bronzes on Main Street, four of them depicting Indians, none of them done by an Indian artist. We told OCF that. OCF gave us a grant. We did a call for Native artists, and over the course of time, Doug Hyde, born in Hermiston, and Nez Perce Indian, who lives in Arizona now, and is working on reservations across the country, came and did one for us. It's a 8-foot granite slab with the figure of an Indian woman carved out of it, and an Indian woman in bronze, a Nez Perce woman, walking back into the mountains, to the Wallao. It's called The Return. Atwayawissa. I hope I've got that right, you Nez Perce speakers out there. We bounce that off Nez Perce elders everywhere, and that's the name that sculpture has. Anyways, that ties art and culture and history and Nez Perce and everything together. And that's when things get great.
You can experience the Joseffy Center and the pervasive presence of the arts in Joseph either by visiting the Wallowa Valley or by taking a virtual tour at joseffy.org. That's Joseph with a Y. Alfred Hitchcock famously made Daphne du Maurier's novel Rebecca into a film in 1940. Dan Webster approaches the Netflix remake with a question. Is this something relevant to today's audiences?
The opening line of Daphne du Maurier's 1938 novel Rebecca is one of the most recognizable in all English literature. Du Maurier's narrator, an unnamed 20-something woman, says, "Last night I dreamt I went to Mandalay again." That same line begins most, if not all, of the many adaptations, stage, television, and screen, that have been made of the book, including what is perhaps the best known, Alfred Hitchcock's 1940 film version that stars Joan Fontaine, Laurence Olivier, Judith Anderson, and George Saunders. Now we have a new adaptation, directed by Ben Wheatley, which stars Lily James, Armie Hammer, Kristin Scott Thomas, and Sam Riley. And while it's difficult to fault either the efforts of the cast or Wheatley's attempts to capture a sense of the mid-1920s, when du Maurier's story is set, it's still appropriate to ask, well, why? Is Rebecca something that holds any relevance to today's movie audiences? Not that we haven't had remakes of other classic films in recent years. In particular, Greta Gerwig's remake of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women took what past production had to offer, including Mervyn LeRoy's 1949 version and Gillian Armstrong's 1994 adaptation, and created something that was faithful to Alcott's source material while managing to update the storyline in a way that fits with 21st century attitudes. Wheatley isn't nearly as successful, but there are a number of reasons why. As you might expect, James, who has starred in a number of films from a Cinderella remake to Baby Driver and last year's Beatles homage Yesterday, stars as our narrator, which is how du Maurier, having never given her character a name, refers to her. After delivering that familiar opening line, she reveals that she is the personal companion, read handmaid, to a wealthy woman, played with no little bit of irony by Anne Dowd, who was so memorable in the Hulu series version of Margaret Atwood's novel The Handmaid's Tale. Unhappy in her role, but having no resources of her own, our young narrator labors for her spoiled, mean-spirited employer during their stay in a posh hotel on the Mediterranean coast. Soon, though, she attracts the attention of, and is attracted in turn by, a middle-aged widower, Maxim de Winter, played by Hammer. And after a mere 2 weeks, the two impetuously decide to marry. That's how quickly it takes for our narrator to transform from little more than a mere girl into Mrs. Maxim de Winter, resident and now matron of the Cornwall estate of Manderley. Ah, but if only the assumption of her new role were that easy. Because not only does the new Mrs. de Winter have to deal with the head housekeeper, Mrs. Danvers, played with sinister effect by Scott Thomas, she quickly discovers that the specter of the former and late Mrs. de Winter still haunts the estate's vast corridors. Naive and all too impressionable, the new Mrs. de Winter comes to believe that her husband still mourns the loss of his first wife. It doesn't help when Mrs. Danvers, whose malicious intentions become more obvious as time passes, tricks our narrator into holding a huge ball and, without the knowledge of her husband, dressing up to look like his former wife. The evening ends disastrously and furthers the new Mrs. de Winter's belief that she'll never measure up. And all this is before a sunken boat is discovered, one with a corpse on board. Mr. de Winter is accused of murder and is subjected to blackmail by a quote-unquote friend of his ex-wife's, the role played by Riley. This series of sudden events brings Du Maurier's story to a climax, and the narrator to a point at which a newfound sense of maturity and confidence begins to blossom. The problem, of course, is that all of this played better in 1940 than it does in 2020. James is good as Du Maurier's protagonist, but Wheatley's film overall suffers from a feeling that it is a museum piece, not just of plotting, but of character development. The notion that a young woman would fall so easily into a relationship with a man twice her own age is antiquated, even if that man is Armie Hammer, who, by the way, is only 3 years older than James's real-life age of 31. And the fact that she would put up with the kinds of abuse that both he and Mrs. Danvers throws at her is also, well, certainly not in keeping with today's Me Too sensibilities. So while this new Rebecca looks good and is fairly true to what novelist Du Maurier created, it fails to have any real meaning in today's world. Wheatley should have paid attention to another 20th century writer, Thomas Wolfe, the title of whose posthumous novel pretty much says it all, You Can't Go Home Again. Even, or especially, if that home is called Manderley. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Dan Webster.
Movies 101 host Dan Webster writes about movies and more for Spokane7.com. Movies 101 is heard Friday evenings at 6:30 here on KPBX. Thanks for listening to Northwest Arts Review. I'm Jim Tevenin. We had help today from Chris Messini and Dan Webster. I'm personally grateful for the generous hospitality of Executive Director Cheryl North Coughlin and Librarian Rich Wanschneider of the Giuseppe Center, and I hope to bring you more from the Wallowa Valley in months to come. More spirited sounds from the EWU Wind Ensemble and Patrick Winters take us out. This time, Bill Whelan's Riverdance finale, arranged by Carl Strumman. Join us again next week for another Northwest Arts Review.